because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's look at the Capitol. J.R., let's do something special this week. It's the next to last Rewind of 2014. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about 8 elected officials who will be leaving the Capitol. You ready?
Sure.
Start with J.B. Van Hollen, who I think we both interviewed yesterday.
Yep.
Here's what intrigues me, J.R. I looked it up. It's been 40 years since a sitting attorney general left by retiring or resigning of their own accord. It's been 40 years. Mm-hmm. He is less than 50 years old, started out as Bayfield National and DA's, then mm-hmm. U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin, 8 years as Attorney General. Why is he leaving?
He doesn't seem to have the fire in the belly to keep doing it. Now, the other thing is, I'm sure he wants to go out and make real money. I mean, look, to you and I, what AG makes is real money.
Yes.
But when you're somebody who's got those kind of law credentials, you can make a lot more money in the real world. Don't forget that J.B. Van Hollen loaned his campaign $600,000 at one point, if I remember this correctly, and was paying it off. So there's, mm-hmm. you know, he pumped some of his own money into a job. If he held that job for 8 years at 100 whatever thousand a year, I mean, he barely made back his investment, right? So, I mean, you think about that. He's got young kids. Yep. He's in the prime of his career. You can do a lot more, you know, financially or in the professional world than be attorney. And I don't want to diminish the AG's office, but there's some opportunities out there for you.
Well, also, I never got the idea that he was comfortable with at least two of the traditional roles of a Paul, and that is the nonstop fundraising and being driven all around the state for Lincoln Day speeches. He just doesn't seem to like that bong clank of politics. Right?
His line has been over and over again, I am not going to approach this job from a partisan perspective. I am approaching it from a legal perspective. I want to be, you know, enforce the law, defend our laws. You know, he's irritated people on both sides of the aisle with how he's handled that office. So you could argue that's a good model to have. But if you're a Republican, you've been unhappy that Van Hollen hasn't been more aggressive on certain things. If you're a Democrat, you're like, this guy's offended gay marriage, he's offended voter ID, he's, you know, da-da-da. So he's really not made a whole lot of people happy, I guess you would say.
He told both of us yesterday, no, he doesn't intend to run for mm-hmm. the Supreme Court seat of Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I mean, he was number one on a lot of people's lists, right, for that?
Kind of, but he's also got a partisan background. And that it is a very thin line between the being a conservative and liberal in these races and being a partisan, having a not just liberal but Democrat or not conservative but Republican on your name. And I do get the impression that it would be kind of a hard jump to make, if you will, to go from, well, I'm a partisan attorney general to being a nonpartisan judge. There's a very small nuance there, but a nuance nonetheless. So I don't know if he was really the ideal candidate. And plus, go back the whole thing with conservatives, they haven't been very happy with him as AG, not being as aggressive as they want him to be. Mm-hmm. So they'd be enthused about him running for the Supreme Court, where they want to have a very hardcore conservative candidate who's going to carry out their ideology, if you will, in the court. So,
but are people like you going to put him on the short list to run for governor in 2016 if Walker doesn't go for a third term?
Interesting. Asked him about governor. He said, you know, I don't lie awake at night dreaming about being governor. He says it's not a very fun job. It's hard work. You know, you're constantly under the grind. And I kind of pushed him, well, are you more likely to run or less likely to run in future for anything? And he said, well, probably less likely. You know, I do think the guy, he is not somebody who, like Governor Walker, who burns to be in public office.
Right.
I think he's got another life, if you will, outside of the confines of the Capitol.
Okay, we're also saying goodbye to Senate President Mike Ellis of NINA, one of the most colorful characters I think I've covered in my 27-plus years in the Capitol. In terms of budgeting, he's brilliant. You know, mm-hmm. a former math teacher, he devised a QEO in the 1990s. Colorful, great sound bites, largely can control his temper. What are you going to remember about Ellis?
Interviewed Scott Fitzgerald this week and said that people don't realize how big a loss he is in the Senate, not in part because of institutional knowledge, but also his understanding of the budget and the way he can present the budget to other members. You know, we all assume that politicians, well, they must know everything. Well, they don't, you know, and they have their expertise, and one of Ellis's was the budget. And being able to break it down, I mean, just like you, I've had many lecture at his chalkboard.
Oh, yeah.
Where he had the entire thing laid out. I've heard him, you know, joust, if you will, with Fiscal Bureau, which you don't usually hear from lawmakers, but he's never been shy about his opinions about how they do their budgeting stuff.
Right.
The other thing about Mike is there is a wing of the Republican caucus in the Senate that is, you know, a little more moderate than others. I'm not going to say they're liberals by any stretch of imagination, but not quite as conservative. And for the last few years, Mike has been the person who has either taken credit or blame for stopping things in the Senate that those folks didn't really like. Now, what's going to happen with Mike gone? Will there be somebody else who will step up and be the person who takes the brunt of these things, or can maneuver behind the scenes, work out a compromise, or will they kind of go along to get along when the push comes to shove on right to work, lifting the cap on vouchers, all these things that have been kind of sticking points before?
You know, I want to tell one Mike Ellis story, because sometimes the truth was kind of a casualty when you're dealing with Mike Ellis. So he's the leader of the Senate in the 1990s, and they're coming up on an election, maybe it was 94, 96. So he takes another member of the Capitol Press Corps, not you, not I, to the Inn on the Park bar, and he says, "Oh, I just got a poll. This Democratic senator in western Wisconsin is in trouble." So the Democrats then pull some of their resources away from the races that and they focus on this western Wisconsin Democratic senator. Ellis made up the poll. He made up the poll. You're not surprised at that, are you?
No.
He told me the story. So this is not a second or third hand.
So he's great. Going into his office at times could be a treat. Listen to him tell stories and go on and on and on. So he very much, he's somebody who enjoyed the game of the Capitol, if you will, the give and take, and really was, somebody who, his presence will be missed in a lot of ways in the Capitol after the session.
Democratic Senator Tim Cullen, 1974 through 1986, majority leader, then he became Tommy Thompson's, then it was Health and Human Services or whatever.
Can you imagine these days Scott Walker picking a Democrat to be in his cabinet?
No, I can't.
Or
no,
Jim Doyle picking a Republican? I mean, that's how different days are now, right?
And then he came back for another term in the Senate. Mm-hmm. What are you going to remember about Tim?
Interesting guy who had, you know, he was one of the ones who had, during Act 10, left the state but tried to negotiate a deal. I don't think Tim ever was really comfortable with the idea of taking off. He wanted to work something out. He comes from the old school of, let's sit down, work out a deal. At a McDonald's not far from my mom's house in Kenosha County, actually, where they met Eric Schutt. But very much that mindset of, we're not here to combat each other, we're here to try and work things out. I don't know if you're going to see that kind of mindset around anytime soon.
Dale Schultz, another, like me, graduate of Madison West High School, served in the 35 years in both houses, including a stint as majority leader. But then he's been on the outs more than anybody else with members of his party. Voted against a budget, voting against a mining bill. So he was willing, the three amigos, you know, we talked about Cullen, and we'll get to Jouk in a minute. What are you going to recall about Dale?
The quite impressive or kind of amazing to watch transformation over the last 4 years from a guy who was the Senate leader at one time of the caucus, deposed Scott Fitzgerald while I was on my honeymoon in 2004 in Italy, deposed him, led the caucus, then fell out of favor in the last 4 years because he voted against all these things. I mean, the question is, did Dale Schultz leave the Republican Party or did it leave him? Now, he would argue he's been a good Republican all these years. It's just these issues they've gone too far on. Where is the room for moderates anymore? I mean, with Jouk, I'm not going to say Jouk is necessarily a real moderate, but at times willing to work across the aisle. Cullen's moderate streak, worked in a Republican administration. Schultz, where are the moderates left in the state capitol right now, especially in the Senate? You know, you could argue there aren't really many anymore.
Were you surprised at how hard he worked to elect a Democrat, Pat Bomhack, in the final weeks leading up to the election?
It was clear he was not happy that Howard Markline decided to challenge him in a primary or tried to push him out, if you will.
Within weeks after getting elected, Markline said, "I'm going to run for the Senate." Excuse me for
Definitely, sometimes politics is personal, and I think that that part of it was both personal for him, that this is a guy who tried to push him out, and he thinks it was a good fit for the district. Now, obviously, Markline did very well down there in a wave year. You could argue that he's more conservative than that district is, but hey, if you can lock it down even more conservative, that's a good sign for you going forward.
And you mentioned Democratic Senator Bob Jouk represented parts of the Northwest. I mean, his district's bigger than three eastern states, I think. He was there for 32 years. He always struck me as someone who really was waiting for David Obie to retire, really wanted to end his career in the U.S. House. But Obie stayed on, and Bob got a few years, and when Obie announced in 2010 wasn't going to seek re-election, Bob just said, "Look, I just can't do this." Your memories of Bob?
My favorite stories about Bob Jouk is John Rickenbach used to be the minority leader in the Senate Democratic Caucus. Told me that he would go up to Bob, and say, "Bob, I need 10 minutes." Bob would hitch up his pants, go on the floor, and he'd give a speech for 10 minutes. You know, he was great. He was one of those guys who believes in the orator, if you will, tradition of being a lawmaker. He loved being on the floor and having that debate, you know, and making his points. He always got his 2 cents in.
Yeah, and he pretty much defines Democrats who believe in the strong role of government. He really passionately believes in that. And he represented one of the poorest districts. Yeah. He really did. In the middle of the mining fight, which is why I never thought he'd retire, because we're still in the middle of a mining fight. So,
but there's nobody left to play in the sandbox anymore for those guys.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, part of it was, who do I stick, if I stick around, for any of them, who do I work with? What's my path forward? And there really isn't anybody.
Adios, three amigos. Schultz, Cullen, and Jauch. Okay, let's take a look at the assembly. I was struck by the retirement of Democratic Representative Sandy Pash. She was an assistant Democratic leader. It seemed to me, well, let me ask the question. Do you think she just got tired? She saw that it was going to be a long time until the Dems come back into control of the assembly, or were there other factors in her mind?
There could be a number of things. You know, I just had enough. Remember, too, that there was some controversy when she ran for this assembly seat in 2012 because, go back, they redrew the districts and drew her into a majority-minority district.
Yes.
And so she was a Caucasian lawmaker running for a black majority district, and that was a sore point for the number of African Americans in Milwaukee because there are limited opportunities to win seats for African Americans and minorities in the state, and they felt like she was taking one. Now, other progressives said, look, she's good on the issues, that's all that matters. But there was some, tension there, and she's being replaced with an African-American lawmaker.
And she did run against Senator Darling in the
recall,
right?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
2011, and, that was at time a swing seat, a Republican-leaning swing seat. Alberta won by a decent margin, partly because of people weren't happy with the recall process, and now it's a safe Republican district out there for her.
Let's talk about a GOP leader, Representative Pat Strakota of West Bend. She passed up a chance to run for Grothman's seat, and she's retiring. Now, the reason I wanted to put on our list is it seems to me she was one of the rocks of the GOP revolution. I mean, she came in 2005, so she came in, the Dems were in control, but she has been a solid member of the Act 10 change and things like that. And now she became, even for a few months, the first female leader of the assembly.
Okay. Served on Joint Finance, obviously a nod to her attributes and her worth as a lawmaker. It's interesting that part of the state is getting way more conservative and has been for a while. If you look at the people who are coming back in those districts, I think all three assembly seats were replaced, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're all being replaced, people who views more conservative than the ones who had them, which is saying something when you consider who had those seats. So you're seeing the deepening reddening, if you will, of certain parts of the state reflected in that Senate district.
And then finally, I put Democratic Representative Mandy Wright of Wausau on the list as somebody just to mention because she seemed to me a pretty good fit for the district. She was a 1995 graduate of Wausau East, a soccer coach, a classroom teacher, and I thought she'd have, this is Donna Seidel's
old seat. Mm-hmm.
I thought she'd have it for a long time. What intrigues me is she told me she raised $100,000 for her campaign, thought that was enough, didn't have to buy TV ads, but the Wisconsin Federation for Children, which backs Choice, came in and reported on GAB statement spending $110,000 against her. Lost by 84 votes. So I'm not going out of my way to praise Mandy or to say anything bad about the incoming GOP rep, David Heaton. I just think it's pretty indicative now of politics in some of these marginal seats.
Well, a couple things, though, about that race. If you remember, Dale Schultz, Mandy Wright, went on a tour of education tour of the state in October, way outside her district.
Yep.
Why would you do that in a swing seat in a year like this? Now, the Republican wave kind of hit late in Wisconsin, so for a while it seemed like even Republicans were telling that she should be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't run a race like that if you're unless it's a safe seat or you don't care.
Yeah.
So she made a mistake in taking her eye off the ball going statewide. Now, could that have gotten 84 votes? Maybe. You never know. It's always hindsight 20/20. But the fact she wasn't there at times, taking time to go other places, that did not help the cause. And in a swing seat in a bad year for Democrats, that's not a good combination.
Right. Okay. Well, those are eight people who I thought we should talk about. Next topic. You interviewed Representative Dean Knutson.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be the point of the spear in changes for GAB. I'm really curious. What changes is he talking about making? And just talk to me about your interview with him.
He's talking about major overhaul and reform, but how that's going to look is not clear yet. One of the problems with doing it is who's going to oversee the overseers, right? So you could do a couple things. You keep the current model with retired judges being appointed, but create some kind of oversight. Well, who would have oversight of them, the people who are subject to their investigations or review, if you will. You could go back to the elections board model, which is what Senator Fitzgerald's talked about that he favors. He believes that you have more accountability because there's an elected official behind the person who's appointed to that board. Now, the problem is with the elections board, a lot of those issues were driven by partisan politics.
And if you have the Dems in control of the old elections board for one legislative session, they'd mm-hmm. make one set of decisions. And then if the pendulum swung and the Republicans came in, they'd reverse and undo the decisions made the previous 2 years. So I just...
You mean like whether you can transfer money from your federal campaign account to your state one to run
for
governor?
Thank you very much. Yes.
You know, things like that?
Yes.
Yeah, so those are definitely issues that come with that board. But to Fitz, it's like, look, this model's not working with the GAB. He thinks it's a rogue agency. There's no accountability. There has to be something changed, and he wants it. Now, the issue is, what do they agree on in the end? They have to reach some kind of compromise to pass a bill. We'll see what Knudsen's bill looks like. He wants to have it done early January to start circulating. We'll see then maybe the details of what his approach is. But can you keep that model? Possibly. I mean, there's also the clean house with the staff. There's another Republican thought that the judges are fine, but they rely on the staff too much. The staff comes in and says, just... here's our recommendation. The judges go, well, okay. You know, because you guys are the experts working every day, we're going to accept it. Might they find something different for the staff to have an advocate for both sides? You know, all kinds of options like
is
that.
Is Knudsen's bill, what's your sense? Is Knudsen's bill going to get into this whole question of we now have almost no limits on campaign donations and whether companies can give? Or
Voss
is he just going to restructure?
He's focused on the GAB. Voss has appointed himself in the assembly the point person on the campaign finance reform. I'll be looking at that. I would assume you can bet that there will not be lower limits on contributions to candidates or political parties once
right.
he's done.
Because they've been unchanged since 1974.
I mean, the argument that he's made is like, look, even if you just do for inflation right now, it's $500 for an assembly candidate. Just for inflation from 74 to now would be about $2,500. That tells you how much things have changed since then.
Yeah.
I would expect there will be some kind of limits on state candidates. They still have to have some kind of contribution limit. But with parties, they operate without any contribution limits this cycle because of a couple Supreme Court federal court decisions. So that model in his mind, hey, it's all reported. You see it on the report. So what's the problem if it's a check for $5,000 or $500,000? As long as you know who it's coming from and where it goes, what's it, you know, that's the thing, is transparency and reportability.
So he wants a bill draft pretty early in the next session?
They're talking about GAB, John Doe, and campaign finance reform early in the session.
John Doe, yeah. I interviewed State Representative David Craig, who's going to be the point person on John Doe. He's what are you trying to do? And he said, we want Doe's, first of all, we want to keep John Doe's, but we want to be sure that they're open only for, quote, serious crimes. Now, nobody's willing to list mm-hmm. which crimes. Would campaign finance issues be serious? Then he wants them open for a specific amount of time. Then if you want to extend beyond that, you have to have a higher set of judges maybe signing off on that. And then he wants the costs. How much are taxpayers paying for this? Now, any PSs on potential changes to John Doe?
I asked Van Hollen about that yesterday. He said, look, I used them when I was a DA, and they can be a good tool if used properly. Now, this all is being driven by the investigations into then County Executive Scott Walker,
yes.
which then developed into the investigation coordination between Governor Walker's campaign and conservative groups. And for Republicans, I think those investigations were unfair, that the prosecutors had a predetermined desire to get Walker and they couldn't,
right.
and that, but they kept going after it even though they didn't have enough to go get him. So for them, it's kind of a little personal, if you will, about this issue. And there's also that on the table of just doing with them all together and do a grand jury process. We're one of the few states that don't have the grand jury process, but have this process.
And a PS right now, the state Supreme Court just agreed to consider, is it three issues involving John Doe's?
Yes. A couple challenges from targets of the investigation, and one it was the decision by the judge overseeing it to quash subpoenas issued in that case. So they're taking all together in one. Interesting about that, Justices Prosser and Abramson, not known for being allies of the court, if you will, concurred on an opinion of going, the way you're doing this is going to cause a problem. There are too many issues involved. We should break this apart into separate issues mm-hmm. and have some other things considered here. So watch that case. It could be a monster day in the court for those oral arguments.
Absolutely. And David Craig says he also would like to have a draft on a John Doe bill pretty early. So you have the specter of perhaps the legislature acting and then the Supreme Court coming out with these rulings on mm-hmm. that issue. Okay. New subject. State audit reported this week that Do I have this right? 1.7 million calls to the Department of Workforce Development mm-hmm. unemployment line went unanswered. I haven't done a lot of work on this, yes. GR. Bring me up to speed.
So essentially, the agency says part of the problem was at the end of last year, there was the expiration of the emergency extension of federal benefits. So they got jammed with calls,
oh, yeah.
all right? They were, people get busy signals, didn't get answers because they just were too, the volume was too high. So all those, I think it was 60% of the calls weren't answered during that period. 2 months later, it was 10% weren't answered because of the volume of calls. It shows you that it's a very busy time. It's also the holiday season, have seasonal work ending, harsh winter weather that, you know, forced some people off the job. So all these things conspire to have that happen. DWD will say, look, we're now doing online applications to make it easier. We're creating new avenues for people to do it on a smartphone, a tablet, and their computer as well as a phone. That should help things a great deal.
Okay.
The other interesting part of that audit was, oh, by the way, we have $168 million in overpayments and unemployment benefits.
Yes.
Of those overpayments, less than 10% were people who intentionally misled the agency. They account for more than half the money overpaid.
Oh, I see.
And some of this money goes back two
less
decades.
Less than 10%.
Less than 10% account for more than half the money.
Oh, boy.
And some claims are overpaid go back 10 years, or go back two decades. So the other interesting thing, if you read deeper into it, is DWD has to report every year to its council about how it's doing with recouping the money.
Mm-hmm.
They're telling you, oh, we have this great rate of getting the money back.
They said they recovered $142.9 million.
Yeah, LAB is saying, well, hold on a second. You're recouping money, but not necessarily that year's money. You're recouping money going back years in some cases.
Oh, so we're rolling it in there.
Yeah, so okay. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison when you say, hey, we had this much in overpayments and get this much back, kind of thing.
What is workforce saying now? Nothing to see here? Everything's been fixed?
No, I mean, it was Republicans are focusing on the whole thing with the overpayments, saying there's more reform is needed. Democrats are focusing on the not helping people when they need help kind of thing, that this is a sign of mismanagement by the administration. We all know, though, that next session, the reforms, if you want, it comes to social, to safety net programs mm-hmm. are going to be
yes.
about what?
Drug Public testing, assistance, drug testing.
Giving people a hand up, not a hand out. Governor Walker likes to talk about, you know, it's not about people are on assistance, but get a job. So that's where the reform is going to be with those agencies, those programs next session.
Okay, thank you. Time for WIS Politics stock reports, sir.
So, Tammy Baldwin, she is following the Herb Kohl model.
The party's going out of power in a few weeks. Go ahead.
She's following the Herb Kohl model of being a U.S. Senator. She landed on appropriations, where Herb Kohl served for a lot of years, focusing on cranberries, focusing on local issues, the transfer of the Badger ammunition plant, right, this land. She's somebody who is going in the model of, I am going to put my head down, work hard, and be involved in local issues, and worry about getting the local paper, not the national news. Now, she's also appealing to moderates with some of the things that she's doing, but she also throws the bone to the base now and then with things like, oh, by the way, I am opposed to President Obama's appointment to the number three position in Treasury. He's too close to Wall Street. So she keeps her credentials with the progressive crowd, showing she's more of a moderate on a lot of issues and doing a lot of good constituent work. Now, Senator Johnson, a little bit different. He was very high profile for a freshman his first couple of years.
Yeah.
Did not translate well into good poll numbers back in Wisconsin. You know, and now he's got to fight some re-election in a couple of years where he's got to knuckle down, raise more money, get out there. He's been actively trying last year or so to be more visible in Wisconsin, like doing local events, because he knows he faces a very difficult environment in 16 with a presidential race on the ballot.
Yep.
Baldwin knows it's the opposite. She's on 18, higher Republican turnout. She needs to have a more of a moderate profile. She's doing the work now to help pay off in 18.
That's a very interesting choice. Mixed.
Scott Walker. Here we are talking about a budget that is not really getting a lot of traction right now, right? He talks about right to work as a distraction. Other distractions are Molotov, you know, Mazel Tov. Agency consolidation, what's it going to look like? Right to work, he's saying, hold off. Republicans saying, no, we're going to do it. I mean, it's kind of this weird spot for Walker where he's got all this political capital, right? He just won this big election, third election in 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
What's he spending it on? Consolidating state agencies. Why? You know, why is that the big push for Scott Walker?
JR, when you told me you were going to list Walker as mixed, here's what I thought. I thought in the wake of Jeb Bush taking a serious step forward and Walker being asked, what does Jeb Bush taking a serious step forward to the presidency mean for you? I thought that's why you would have him mixed.
No, look at the state stuff that's going on. I mean, do you see his budget is going to be, he faces, the $2.2 billion number is not real. That's wish list number. The real number is about $1 billion.
Yeah.
That number is real.
That is real.
He's got a problem with that. He's got to find a way to cover that number, find some property tax relief, and do this reform with schools, right? That's what he's talking about. Now he's going to cut the size of government. There is a perception that he has a desire to that because he wants to prove that I'm a reformer, I cut government, that kind of thing. Also, by the way, plays well nationally, runs for president. Look, I took on the unions, I cut taxes, and I cut the size of state government in Wisconsin. This kind of blue collar, this blue-leaning state, I did all these things as governor. Nationally, though, now, the Jeb Bush thing is not that big a deal for Walker in some ways because Jeb Bush appeals to a donor base in Florida, a little bit in Texas, the family ties. He's not necessarily the social conservative that Walker is on Common Core and other things. So Walker has his national fundraising base from running, you know, the recall elections. It maybe kind of shields him from that. Hurts Christie more than does Walker. And oh, by the way, Common Core, what's Governor Walker saying now?
Maybe we just need to repeal
requiring them to do.
Let's give our 424 school districts the options of whether they want to stick with.
So there's these subtle shifts that are going on right now with him. So a little bit of, you know, it's he's just not. There's not this big bold Walker right now. Now maybe the budget comes out in a month and it's big bold Walker again. But right now it's kind of like these nuances of Walker.
So he's mixed. Okay, falling, sir.
Unemployment insurance program. I mean, you've got one. The calls aren't being answered, and two, the money's, you know, going out the door. So it's. It's not the best thing. We'll see how these reforms work with the you know, the new ways to apply. But overall, it's not the best thing to have on your resume right now.
I agree. Okay. Let's talk about our year-end rewind. Mm-hmm. And as a Christmas Eve gift to you viewers, we're going to pick the top 10 events. So I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And that's Rewind for December 19th.